mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. The place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub Saturday nights here on News Radio 570 WWNC plus AM 1400, and they don't call it the talk of the mountains for nothing. Well, let me tell you, my guest tonight needs no introduction, but here we go. He is an icon who has contributed incredible creativity and insight to the process of exploring our world. He's the author of classic works of fiction like Wolfen and many books that are on the edge of reality, like Communion, about his experiences with visitors from beyond, the coming global superstorm that inspired the movie The Day After Tomorrow, authored with Art Bell, and his newest book, The Key, A True Encounter. He's the host of Unknown Country, a one-man point of contact to other realms. Mr. Whitley Strieber, welcome, sir, to Speaking of Strange.
Well, I'm very glad to be here.
Well, it's a great honor because you interviewed me years ago, and we got to meet briefly out west in Los Angeles doing the show with George, but I know you are a busy man, and it just probably seems to be getting busier and busier. Do you find that phenomena is indeed picking up and accelerating right now, Whitley?
Yeah, there is something going on, certainly. The whole way it looks in terms of the, like the sky phenomenon, the UFOs and so forth, is changing. They're getting lower and slower, basically. And there's also a smattering of, here and there on the internet, a couple of videos that might actually be of real videos of aliens, if indeed they even are aliens. We don't even know what they are. But it's gone through phases like this before. There was a phase in from 1950 culminating in a huge event that took place in 1952 that ended with the famous July of 1952 Washington overflight, which really stunned the world. That was the one that the I believe that the Air Force blamed on swamp gas. That it became famous for that, and a lot of newspaper people and columnists vociferously refused to accept that explanation. But recently, first of all, with more people in the world and more people with video cameras and so forth, you see more stuff. But just in terms of sheer weirdness, there's a lot of just weird, off-the-wall stuff happening right now. Like a couple nights ago in Fort Worth, there was an electrical storm. Okay, that's not weird. But what was weird was a couple of hundred transformers blew up, but there's no lightning. It was videotaped. And you see this video of them, just one after another, just exploding across the horizon. Power went out all over town in all kinds of different places. What happened? What made them explode? A guy from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram said it was like there was fire on the ground. And
wow.
You just get one story like this after another these days.
Well, you know, it seems like that for those who are aware, there is more information available to prepare. And of course, that's a great way of building up to The Key and what The Key is about, because it is based upon this extraordinary encounter you had with a mysterious man. But you have a history of these kinds of amazing encounters. I mean, for me, seeing an alien type being, you know, would be a jarring, life altering experience, barely imaginable. But you have had them just literally hang out at your house. Is that right? I mean, like in your living room. Is that true?
We've had, yeah, it's been, to say the least, an unusual life. I wanted a quiet life. I became a writer. I come from a family that was heavily involved in politics, not elective politics so much. One of my uncles was a chairman of the Democratic Party of Texas back during the days of Alan Shivers and then into LBJ. And I didn't want that life. I wanted a quiet life, and so I became a writer. It hasn't been quiet at all. Boy, it's been really, really something. I just cannot explain it, but it has been extraordinarily weird. My wife and I, we were talking the other night. I've got a book coming out in January called What is to Come, which is sort of the solution to the communion enigma. I'm just finishing it now. And we were talking about our life together, and the weirdness started long before I wrote Communion. We just didn't think of it that way. We just sort of accepted these strange, bizarre events as being, you know, we were a couple of kids, and we didn't, you know, we figured it happened, must be happening to everybody if it was happening to us. And then came the Close Encounter of the Third Kind in 1985, and obviously it was a fairly unusual experience until I published the book, and they began bringing in mail by the bag. I mean, by the bag, thousands and tens of thousands, and finally hundreds of thousands of descriptions of things like that happening to other people. So it's not all that unusual, actually.
Well, I know you have had such success. You get asked so many questions. Sometimes it almost must become burdensome to describe some of the experiences that you've had for the millionth time. But let me just ask you this. When you're in a situation like you were in New York, out there, you know, in a very rural area, and you have a visitor in your home, we know what they look like, but what does it feel like in the room? I mean, what is that connection? Do you feel like this is a being that is dominant, or do you, I mean, what, how can you describe that overall atmosphere, just sharing space with them, for lack of a better word, socially?
Well, first of all, I wish I could say that one of them had once sat down at a table with me or had a discussion. It was never like that. Second, I think the best way to describe this is to describe it through the experience of one of the many people who used to go to that cabin and have encounters. Raven Dana was her name, and she's spoken about her encounter, and it's written up in, I believe, in my book Breakthrough. So it's, you know, it's a matter of public knowledge. It's not a secret. And what happened was this: she was in a bedroom downstairs, and we had gone out to a cave, and I used to go into this cave alone at night. You know, saying that, it was about a mile out in the woods on a cliff that overlooked a stream, and to get to it, you had to slide along a little ledge that was about 5 or 6 inches wide with this stream often roaring below you. And then you would get into the cave, and you were helpless in that cave. There was nothing you could do. You couldn't get out quickly in any way whatsoever. I would go in there alone and turn off my flashlight, unarmed in any way, because that was when the visitors would come closest to me. Now, I think back on doing that, and I wonder if I could do it again.
Yeah.
In any case, we went out there, a whole group of us, and we went into the cave, because I knew they wouldn't show up in the cave with a bunch of people in it, but it might attract their attention as it had before and draw them to the cabin later at night. Because you understand, they were like little shy forest creatures. This is not like a kind of aliens with fancy equipment or anything. It doesn't feel like that at all. It has a very different gestalt, completely different from that, at least in my case. So we go in the cave and we chant and we do all this mumbo jumbo, that whatever anybody wanted to do they thought might help, and then we go back, all seven of us creeping along this ledge, and I'm thinking about the lawsuits and so forth, but we all lived, got back to the house, and eventually went to bed. And I say bed in quotation marks, because on these deals at this cabin, nobody slept. That wasn't what it was about.
Yeah.
So this lady is in a bedroom downstairs, lying in bed. I have long since, back, this is now about 2 years after the first encounter, and even before that encounter, I had had all of the screens screwed shut downstairs, and because I was not interested in people coming in there. I had alarm systems out the wazoo, the screens screwed shut. So she's lying in this bed, and all of a sudden, something she sees something moving at the foot of the bed, and she opens her eyes, and she thinks, oh, my God, it's a raccoon. A raccoon has come in the window. And then she thinks, well, wait a minute, aren't the screens so closed, screwed shut? Now, at this point, we had a low-light camera set up in the hallway so that anyone who moved through the hallway between the two bedrooms that were in the, on that floor had to go in front of that camera. Then the next thing she realizes is it's one of these little creatures. It's a gray. It's one of these visitors. And she said it stank, it like the forest floor, like it had come out from under the ground, which they often did. They had a very, some of them, mushroomy kind of smell. Not all, but some did. And it, she reached out toward it, and it touched her hand. And when it touched her hand, she felt this very pleasant kind of gentle electrical shock. And it asked her, what can I do to help you, or what can I do for you? And it didn't, whether it spoke in words or in her head or whatever, she didn't know, but she got that question. And she said, you could walk down that hallway. So it got off the bed, and she said it was not but 3 or so feet tall, and that was true of most of them. Some of them were a little taller. And it went out the door and then went into another bedroom and woke up the two women in that bedroom, who proceeded to have something close to a conniption fit. But they, I mean, they held themselves together. They didn't go into a screaming frenzy, fortunately. And we don't know what happened then, because the next thing they knew, they woke up in the morning. The lady who had touched them had remained awake most of the night, and she had been lying in there and feeling very strange and afraid to move because of the way it made her feel. It made her feel very dizzy to move. In the morning when she woke up, she was completely... She was having a terrible allergy attack, which was a big issue if you touched them. As I had found out, I had epinephrine injectors all around the house because touching them, which I did sometimes, caused a big allergic reaction. And so she comes out and she says, I saw one, and it was like a little animal. At first I thought it was a raccoon, Whitley. It just felt so natural, so much of part of nature. And I said, I know, it's like that. It seems like not that big a deal when they're around. They don't have any fancy equipment or anything. They kind of come up out of the ground, or they suddenly appear in a room or walk in a door. And they do strange things. There was a carpenter was building a house up the road from us, and he had the house all closed in. He hadn't finished closing in the house, and he had his tools there, so he decided to spend the night there.
All right, tell you what, Whitney, we got to take a break. So let's just pause it, because this is great, and we'll get the resolution of that story leading up to how these experiences also have connected into the encounter creating the key. That's Whitley's new book. It's a true encounter, and let me tell you, you must read this book. There is a link at speakingofstrange.com. Talking to the one and only Whitley Strieber. We'll be right back here on Speaking of Strange. I'm Joshua P. Warren. His name, you should know him well. He is a legend of exploration. His new book is called The Key. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. In the meantime, we're talking about the backstory behind some of the contacts that he has dealt with in his life that maybe prepared him for what happened with the key. Some good, some bad. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. So, Whitley, did this woman staying in your cabin have a bad reaction to the aliens, if we can call them that, the visitors?
Well, yeah, the first lady did. She touched one and got this. I took a picture of her. She's all swollen up and looking pretty freaked out the next morning. But she handled it fairly well. The thing that was unfortunate, though, is this. We had this low-light camera going, and I'm going to get back to the story of the carpenter in just a minute, but I just want to finish this. We didn't get a thing on it. We got some unusual sounds, maybe, you know, little thuds and things, but who knew what they really were.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get a single image on it. Of course, this was like in the late 80s or early 90s, and that type of equipment wasn't nearly as good then as it is now, so who knows. But we didn't ever get anything. I tried many, many ways of getting photographs and so forth, and it was very frustrating. Anyway, but to go back to the other story about the high level of strangeness that's involved in this, this carpenter was stayed in this house that he because it was still not locked, and his tools were in it that last night, and he didn't want to be without his tools. He wakes up in the middle of the night, because he notices or hears movement, and he thinks it's somebody stealing his tools, of course. He opens his eyes to see what he said was a little man in standing there kind of in the dark across the room. He was in a sleeping bag in the living room. And he turned on his flashlight, and the little man turned into a bird of paradise before his eyes, this beautiful bird, and then just disappeared. That kind of thing happened along that ridge in those days all the time. And that's what I'm talking about, the incredibly high level of strangeness. What he did then was he figured the tools can manage the rest of the night on their own. I'm getting out of here, and he left.
Yeah, right.
anyone would. But it was full of strangeness, and there was something going on underground there. And I'll tell you why I know that. We had a co-op road, in other words, a private road, and we all chipped in to keep the road up. And one day, a group of us were sort of talking on the phone because we needed some road work done. There'd been a lot of rain. And a guy came over to talk about the road. And that previously that morning, Ann and I had heard what sounded like drilling underneath the house, this high-pitched drilling sound, like somebody, almost like a dentist drill, but much bigger, deep under the house. It was a kind of odd thing to be hearing because it's all a big iron tailing under there. You'd think that there wouldn't be anybody drilling in that because it's so hard. So, and anyway, there was no mines under there. There were some mines north of there, but not where we were. So we're sitting there talking, me and this lawyer, and he talking about the road and what we're going to need to do and who we should get bids from and everything. And this drilling keeps going on under the house. And, you know, he's not noticing it. I'm sort of aware of it. But then all of a sudden, a stream of blood starts shooting out of the center of the man's forehead.
Okay.
And, you know, he's shocked. And my wife rushes in with Kleenex and starts helping him, and he, you know, gets it staunched, and he leaves, never to return, as you may imagine. Communion was being written then. It hadn't been published, so nobody really knew in the neighborhood. Later he told me, I'm never going back to your house again.
Well, you know, that's one thing that I'm really curious about, that sometimes, you know, bad things, harmful things can happen. And,
yeah.
And one of the things that you brought awareness to that is greatly misunderstood and very frightening is the reality of being probed by these visitors. I mean,
well, you know, I became a laughingstock because in those days I was too shy to tell the truth. I was raped. Probed is not the right word. I was raped badly. I was injured badly. And I had to endure years of laughter over being raped. And it was my fault because I was too shy. I wouldn't leave it out because I felt a moral obligation to put in every word of that hypnosis session, including that. It took me 20 years even to say that word to my wife. Now I can speak it quite openly. I've gotten used to it. It's been 5 years since I first told her, and now I can say it publicly. I was raped. I was raped so badly that my doctor, when he examined me, he said, "Whitley, you've been raped." And I was so ashamed and embarrassed because I'm a man. You know, men don't get raped. And we thought I had been the victim of a crime, not of aliens. It never crossed my mind. I mean, I said to him, I described this thing. He said, "Well, it sounds like you're telling me you were taken aboard a flying saucer by little men." And I said, "Well, of course I wasn't taken aboard a flying saucer by little men." And then when he completed the examination, he yells out all of a sudden, he says, "Whitley, you've been raped." And it just shattered me, frankly. It was an injury so severe, in fact, that the last time I was treated for it was 6 weeks ago, because it did not heal properly, and I've been suffering from it ever since, for 25 years. So I guess it's still laughable in some ways, but I'm not laughing, not personally.
Well, it's scary as hell, and what do you think could be the purpose of this? Is this just mean-spiritedness that we have to get used to by these visitors, or I mean, is there another purpose for it?
You know, if you turn this thing around and you assume that, you say to yourselves, okay, we can travel among the stars, or we can travel through parallel universes or wherever they come from, and we find a less advanced species, and one that's maybe very difficult to deal with and very violent and possibly much larger than we are, and it all begins to fall together and to make sense. Because, first of all, the consistent thing is always the same. They're extremely secretive. People always say, "Well, why doesn't the government disclose this?" It's not their business. If the government even knows anything about it, one thing is very clear. It's not them that are in control of the secrecy, because these little fellas could walk down the street anytime they pleased, I think. And they don't. Therefore, they're the ones in control of the secrecy. They want the secrecy. And anyway, what we would do is we would want to examine, to learn about this species of intelligent creatures that we found. They might be real rare. In fact, we might be the only one we've ever found in all the years we've been searching through the stars. And so we would do with them exactly what anthropologists do when they find a lost tribe, is they acclimatize themselves very carefully. They obtain samples of different things in order to get DNA analysis done. And in this particular case, it goes a step farther. They obtain sexual material, eggs and sperm, and probably do it for the same reason that our scientists do it out in the veldt, in the wild, to examine and possibly do creational experimentation and stuff. They do not treat us in any way like we treat humans. They're not putting us on a pedestal. They look upon us as part of the fauna of the planet, obviously. They don't think of us as being having a special place in the universe or in the world like we think of ourselves at all. And so it all makes kind of sense. I mean, I think that they're taking samples, frankly. And if you wonder, well, why don't they just come and land? Well, look what we do. We're not going to land, and here's why. There were for years rumors that the U.S. was firing on these things when it could. And I didn't know what to think. You hear these stories all the time from UFO people and soldier stories from pilots in bars. You just don't know what to think. However, here's the story that came out. A guy named Frank Ficino wrote a couple of books about, called Shoot 'Em Down, another UFO book, and he almost but not quite proved that back in the 50s we had been firing at them very actively. Then all of a sudden, in October of 2008, I believe, the British Ministry of Defense publishes a whole slew of UFO documents, and in and among those documents is one blockbuster. It is a description of an attempt over Surrey in 1956 to shoot down a UFO on the part of an Air Force flight wing, and it even mentions the name of the guy who was in command of it, Milton Torres. So people in the press immediately look him up and find out, yeah, he's still very much alive and he lives in Florida. And so he starts giving interviews and he says, yeah, I was scrambled and ordered to shoot this thing down. It was the size of an aircraft carrier. But when we armed our rockets, it disappeared before our eyes and off radar and it was gone.
Wow.
Now,
okay. We got about a minute till our break, by the
way. Okay, I'll sum it up very quickly. There is in the Indian Ocean, a little island that the Indian government protects. No one's allowed to go near it because on it is a tribe that knows nothing about the outside world. After the tsunami, the Indian government sent a helicopter to fly around the island to see if these people were okay. And there they were, out on the beach, the first helicopter or airplane they'd ever seen. And there they were with their swords and their spears and their arrows and their shields, yelling and screaming and firing arrows at it. So, are you really going to land into that nonsense? Of course not. And that's what we're doing.
Wow. Okay, that is an excellent, excellent point. And I think that's what is important for us all, to start becoming less egocentric and self-centered and start thinking about the reality that we are not the only dominant thing in this vast, incomprehensible universe. And that's one great thing about my guest, Whitley Strieber. He has always had that open mind to put things in their proper place, to scale them appropriately, and maybe that's why that he has been more aware in general of these interactions and why that, well, when you notice them, they notice you, so to speak. His new book is called The Key, A True Encounter, and we're going to talk about that soon. It is a fantastic read. He's always putting out good books, though. His new one coming out next, I think, What Is to Come, it's going to be another hit. There's a link at speakingofstrange.com. I'll be right back with more. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
And you are listening to Speaking of Strange with none other than Joshua P. Warren.
Then the loud sound that seemed to fight came back like a slow voice on a wave of fight. That weren't no DJ, that was crazy cosmic time. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He knows it's not to know it, because he knows it's all worthwhile. He's human. Let the children use it. Let the children use it. Let all the children do it.
Broadcasting live from Asheville, North Carolina, land of the sky. I am your host, Joshua P. Warren. My guest this hour, a legend, an icon, an explorer of minds and worlds, Mr. Whitley Strieber. And, one thing that I really enjoy so much about you and your work, Whitley, is that you are willing to look at the full honest spectrum, the positive and the negative, and those strange areas in between. And before we move on to the key, since the idea of being victimized is something that makes us all cringe and feel so helpless, recently I have HBO. I was watching this documentary that came on called Thinking Triple X about the adult film industry. And you were interviewed for that. And
it was.
And you said, quote, the first true alien video is almost certainly going to be porn, end quote. And I was like, wow, what does that mean?
Well, what I figured, I mean, it's an incredibly sexy experience. It is for everybody involved in it. And if it repeats in your life, it gets even more intense that way. And especially for a conservative, very private man like me, it's certainly, I mean, they have a whole different attitude, let me put it that way. And I had experiences with some of them that were pretty challenging in that respect. There were sometimes levels of physical attraction, not on my part, but on theirs, that were shocking, that made me think, you know, I couldn't be attracted to anybody that looked like that, so why do they find me attractive?
Mm-hmm.
Were they once human, or are they human now? And I'll tell you, one of my closest friends is a photographer who lives in New York, and I know, in fact, he was the guy who did Triple X, Timothy Greenfield Saunders. And after the thing had come into focus, and I guess about February of 1986, and I had realized that I hadn't been the victim of any kind of a normal crime. In other words, these people weren't going to be getting arrested by the New York State Criminal Investigation Division. I told Timothy what happened. I told it before I told my wife, because how do you tell your wife a thing like that? And, you know, Tim's got a great sense of humor. He's been around the block. He knows everybody who in the world, practically. I mean, he's amazing, amazing. He's photographed everyone, presidents, you name it. And I figured, you know, with his experience of life and his cynical sense of humor, he would figure out some way for me to tell my wife without throwing me out of the house. And so I told him about it. And, you know, he was fascinated, and we plotted, and we finally figured out how to tell Ann, and I told Ann. When I told Ann, actually, she was relieved. She thought I was going nuts, and she said, oh, good, now it's explained. It was aliens. It was aliens. Okay, well, hey, we're okay now. But anyway, years later, the reason I bring up Timothy is this, and it's related to what you said. We were leaving New York, Ann and I, for the last time, and we were on the road on the way to driving down to Virginia on the way to Texas. Suddenly the phone in the car rings. It's Timothy. He says, Whitley, I just encountered that lady from the cover of Communion on 14th Street. And I said, Timothy, are you lying? He said, absolutely not. He said, I was stuck in traffic, and I was driving east, and suddenly she walked up and leaned in the window of the car and said, are you going west? And he said, no, I'm going east. And she said, well, that's good. And she turned around and walked away. And he said, Whitley, she has those big, deep, weird eyes, but she's much prettier than you portray her on the cover of the book. On the cover of the book, she looks like a monster, but she's actually not at all. And I said, yeah, I know. I couldn't seem to get the artist to do it. He couldn't make the eyes deep like they really are. And then he said, I almost wanted to... No, he didn't say that. I thought of him. I thought to myself, I wonder if he would have liked it if she got into the car.
Uh-huh.
There's something there, is what I'm saying. It's not all darkness and evil aliens and stuff. This is a whole big, complicated, unknown, wild, wonderful, scary, dangerous, and deeply human experience at its core.
Wow, that is just profound. Well, I know we could talk for hours and hours, and everybody you meet wants to do that, but we've got one more break in about 3 minutes, and then we'll have to wrap up the show. Let's talk about your book right now, The Key, speaking of encounters with strange people. How did this book come together?
Okay, here's what happens. 1998, it's June of 1998, I'm asleep in a hotel room in Toronto. There comes a knock at the door. I assumed it was the room service waiter, but I thought it was about 12. I didn't realize it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I opened the door, My tray was still there. And this man comes in. He walks right in. At first, for the first second, couple of seconds, I've been asleep, and I still think it's the room service waiter. I mutter something about the tray, but then he walks across the room and turns around in front of the window and just starts talking. And I think, oh, no. A fan, and not a real fan, would never do this, but has come in the middle of the night, and the rule of thumb is absolute. You don't want anyone who wants to talk to you in the middle of the night to be anywhere near you, ever. Because they're almost always drunk, and they're almost always furious at you. And so he starts talking, and after a couple of seconds, I mean, after not a couple of, first I started to try to throw him out, and then he said some interesting things. He said something about the Holocaust that was very strange and interesting. And then he starts talking about different aspects of science and things. And it was really an interesting man. And so I thought, I'm just going to start asking questions. I asked him a few questions. And then I picked up a notepad and I took some notes. They weren't very good notes, and I sort of scribbled them down. But I took some notes and I listened and talked and became the most incredible, profound, wonderful, illuminating conversation I have ever had in my life. It lasted maybe 45 minutes at most, 30 to 45 minutes. Then he left. And I was perfectly happy. What a great experience. What an interesting man. And the next morning I wake up and I think, well, hey, I'm going to call him. And I want to get, maybe I'll have lunch with him. I've got some time before the plane leaves for Texas. Who is he? No idea. Didn't leave a phone. I have no identification. And so I went down to the front desk and I said, do you have any record? Someone came into my room, came and visited me late last night. Did he leave any kind of word as to who he was or anything? The guy says, no, we don't let people in that hour. We would have called ahead and only if it was an emergency. So I don't know to this day who he is. I have no idea. But I do know this. This was one of the most incredible people who's ever lived. He had predictions about science that are just now coming true. That's why I finally published the book now, because I think it's irrefutable. The original edition is there in black and white. Now, here's the new edition, and it points out all the things in it that this guy said that have come true, which is incredible.
Okay, wonderful stuff. We're going to take our last break. When we come back, just a few more minutes left with Whitley Strieber, and I have one last question to ask you. It's about an anecdote that Jim Mars told me about a lunch you two had together, and it's just really fantastic. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. I'm talking with Whitley Strieber. What can I say? He's a legend. He's the best. Just go to his website. You know, it's linked up at speakingofstrange.com. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Speaking of Strange will be right back after this. Minutes of tonight's second hour, talking with Whitley Strieber here on Speaking of Strange. I am Joshua P. Warren. And Whitley, one thing I've wanted to ask you about for a long time. Jim Morris told me that one time, years ago, he was having, lunch with you and a few other people. I think it was connected to a conference next to a waterway of some kind. And at one point, they looked to you, and you looked like you'd suddenly become meditative. And they said, Whitley? And you said, the visitors are near.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then right after that, there was an eruption outside, excitement, and all these people outside had seen this huge, like, cigar-shaped object. One guy even videotaped it.
Yeah, they got video.
And you went up to the room and watched it. My question is, do you, I mean, what is this special sensitivity you have? Can all people do this? What happened to you in that moment when you knew something was nearby? What did you feel?
It's a good question. In 1989, an implant was put into my left ear by two people, not aliens. And it was put in May of 1989, and I was awake when it happened. I just couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't move. I saw them come into the room. I heard them, others talking outside. I felt them touching me and moving my body, but I was rendered physically helpless. When I tried to have the thing taken out by a doctor, it moved down from the top of my ear, where it is housed, into the bottom of my ear, into the lobe of my ear. And he pulled out because he had never encountered anything like that before, obviously. He got a little sliver of it, which he took to sent to a pathologist who said, it's the strangest thing I've ever seen. It's got cilia on it, which is, of course, what made it move, like little tentacles. That's scary. And they're embedded in a metal base of some kind. And it moved back to that point later. But since then, I've been very aware of when these things are around. They have a big, they're very noticeable if you have that level of awareness. And we were at Gulf Breeze, Florida, at a conference at that time, and I felt them come over the building, over the restaurant where we were eating. And, you know, I reacted accordingly. And as it happened, there were some people outside who also saw this thing and took video of it. I didn't take all that much notice of it. I have to be truthful. I'd gotten quite used to that sort of thing by then. And so, you know, as far as I was concerned, my main interest was in getting finished with lunch before we had to go back to the conference and give a speech.
And how would you describe in a few words what that sensation is like when they are
very peaceful?
Really?
Oh, yeah. You feel a sense of peace, of the presence of the sacred. It is really very nice. It's a lovely feeling. And, you know, I know a guy who, a brilliant man, I shouldn't say call him a guy, he's a brilliant professor, Jeff Kripal, who is the chair of the Department of Religion at Rice University, who looks into this kind of thing in a different way than a UFO investigator would. And he said, you know, the sacred is not necessarily pretty, and it's not necessarily fun. It can be very scary and very intense and very dangerous. It can be overwhelming, and this can be all of those things. But at a moment like that, there is a sense of profound sense of the sacred. And what happens to my body was I get a very intensified sensation of my physical presence and kind of a sense of my reality as I am, as a being. And I'm much less in my ego and much more aware of myself as part of a huge continuum of humanity. And there comes with it almost a sense of laughter. And you know, that was what was the thing about the Master of the Key that was sort of authentically wonderful about him, was that as he talked, he was bubbling. I mean, you could almost feel him about to burst into laughter at any moment. And he was delighted. He's delighted to be alive. And it's a message worth listening to, I think. I mean, you have the darkest, most difficult experiences in the world, scary experiences with the visitors, but the truth was, when I went out there in the woods in the night by myself, facing this down and facing them, I didn't feel like I was in the presence of demons or anything evil. I felt as if I was in the presence of something very old and very interested and very intent on its purpose. That's what it felt like.
We are very fortunate that you are a person who has had these experiences, who also possesses the talent to be able to write so well, to articulate this, to describe it, to help the rest of us understand. And there is no such thing as coincidence. We both know that. So all I can say is you continue to enlighten us. I hope everybody will read everything that you write.
Thanks.
And thank you so much for being on the show tonight, Whitley Strieber. It's been a great honor.
Thank you, and they can go to motkbook.com to watch a video and ask me questions. I'm there.
motkbook.com. Excellent. Thank you, Whitley Strieber. There you have it, folks.
You.
You got the full spectrum in an hour right there, and when we come back, it'll be the dark 30 hour when we dig into the most outrageous and controversial news of the past week and maybe weeks. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's Speaking of Strange.